Hey, y'all. The topic today is postgraduate training for PAs and NPs in critical care. And you know, a great place to hear about this more would be over at the Intensive Care Academy. That's our other subscriber-based platform where you can view all kinds of videos on critical care topics by Brian and I, but also a couple other formats, including two additional podcast feeds available to subscribers only, including the what used to be the Turbos on this feed, and also monthly live streams. You could chat with Brian and I, and this is a topic that's coming up in this month as well. So go check it out if you have not. It's ICU101.com. Lots of good stuff, including continuing education for those who need those credits. ICU101.com. On to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It is Brandon Odo back with Brian Bowling.
Hey, everybody.
We're going to chat today about a topic that we were just realizing we had never really tackled in a specific focused way. I mean, we've talked about topics around this probably many times, but the topic is, how do we say this broadly? Postgraduate training programs for advanced practice providers in critical care. And usually that means PAs or NPs. And by advanced, by postgraduate programs, I mean a program you go into after you graduate from school, your PA or NP program, that meant to train you to work in critical care. And of course, this wouldn't need so much explanation for, let's say, physicians, all of whom do postgraduate programs. They go to a residency, and then if they specialize, they go to a fellowship. But in our world, it's just not so formalized or standardized, meaning one, these things are not required, at least not to work in any state and probably not in, I don't want to say any, but most any employer. It's optional training. And even the terminology is not standard. That's why I'm being so nebulous about it. Some people call it a residency. Some people call it a fellowship. I'm sure there's some other name. Maybe we'll talk about some of that today. But the topic of these sorts of programs is interesting. And I think we're at a point where it's worth a little more attention to ask questions like, should you go to one of these if you're at that point in your life considering it? What does a good one look like? What's the point? Why is it? I mean, again, it's optional. So there was always that question of why, like what's the point? And so on. I went to such a program. We called it a residency at Johns Hopkins many years ago. Brian has been involved with some. They're around, they're growing, but it is still, I think, a minority more or less for most people. So let's chat about it today. And we're going to talk to Melissa Bridges here, who's going to give us some additional insight. Melissa is the director of the PA Fellowships at Atrium Health, which includes several different hospitals. And that's not specifically for critical care, but kind of their various inpatient programs. So she has a good high-level kind of leadership perspective on all of this, in addition to the much lower budget, less valuable perspectives from Brian and I. But certainly a hodgepodge of views, at least. So welcome, Melissa.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on the podcast today.
Well, I should also say that Melissa is the president of APAP, which is the, I'm going to get this wrong, Association of Postgraduate PA Training Programs. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, great. I do the same with our organization. I always think, is the A for association or American, but it's always the association. So
we just call it Tylenol in America. So
yes, that's right. And also, I should mention that I am the president of APGAP, which is the Association of Postgraduate APRN Training Programs, so the nurse practitioner equivalent, I guess, of APAP. So so we kind of come to this from both the perspective of being involved in individual programs and also sort of on a national level with these things. So we thought the two of us getting together here and Brandon would bring at least a little bit of legitimacy to this conversation. So Melissa, let's start real quick. Brandon mentioned that he had done a fellowship, or actually a residency. We'll get to that in a minute too. I did not, but I've been involved with the Critical Care Fellowship at the University of Kentucky since its inception in various roles where I currently coordinate the SimLab training for that group. What about you? What's your background as far as personal involvement with these types of programs.
Yes, thank you so much. Following graduation from PA school, which I will disclose, I did not get a critical care elective within my training, ultimately elected to seek a fellowship program to further my medical knowledge and introduce me to critical care concepts that, again, didn't have access to in PA school. And then following completion of my critical care fellowship, I've been in critical care ever since.
Great. So let's talk, because you sort of alluded to why you chose to do one of these training programs. This is the question I get from people all over the place. Podcast listeners, people who I know through AppGap, people who I know through teaching, et cetera, is, should I do one of these programs? Currently, like Brandon said, they're not required in the United States, unlike physicians. That may or may not change in the future. There's people advocating for that, people advocating against that. But from your perspective, because I can share my thoughts, but you, from your perspective, should you do one of these? Who should do one?
And just to kind of contextualize that again, the state of the world is always, one, it's not required, and two, there are sacrifices, right? So if you were a physician, you wouldn't have this question because it'd be mandatory. But typically, there's a pay cut, so you're earning kind of trainee money at most of these places. And typically, you're working more than you would in just a regular staff position. So in practical ways, it's the drag. And so very reasonably, someone might be like, why would I do that?
Great question. And this is nationally one of the most commonly asked questions we receive as well. So I'll say first, it comes down to really enhancing your medical knowledge and clinical skills. Even as a student, if you're afforded a critical care rotation, or for nurse practitioners, you may have a required critical care rotation, you're not really fully a licensed provider, really owning the responsibility. So fellowship training really offers you this specialized training to deepen your medical knowledge, your understanding of critical care concepts, as well as your expertise to practice in specialty areas within critical care. Again, critical care is so broad. So how can you truly become the content expert in all of these subspecialties in such a short amount of time? Most nurse practitioner and PA programs are about 2 years in length or less. So there's just not enough time to diversify the clinical rotations in that amount of time. I'll say another huge benefit is the professional development and the what we call clinically adjacent education and opportunities. So gone are the days of just showing up to work and doing a good job. Employers are really looking for those professionals who are willing to contribute in scholarly work, quality improvement, professional speaking, committee work, leadership, et cetera. So fellowships are really well equipped to help build that adjacent professional skill set that becomes highly attractive to your future employer.
Yeah, and that's basically kind of along the lines of what I always tell folks is, the short answer is, should I do one of these programs? And the short answer, I think, is if you feel like you should, right? If you feel like it would benefit you. The longer version I usually say is something like kind of what you said. Depending on what your background is, depending on what your schooling was like. For nurse practitioners, most, I will say, nurse practitioners who go into critical care are trained in the acute care nurse practitioner model. And for acute care nurse practitioners, there is a requirement for some critical care. It's not 100% across the board. So you can graduate from an acute care program without a critical care, an ICU rotation. It's uncommon, but it does happen. But even then, the quality of that rotation is going to vary depending on, you know, where you went to school. You know, did you go to school that was a big critical care emphasis? A lot are, but some aren't. Did you get to do an ICU rotation in an ICU where you saw some acuity? Not all ICUs are created equal, right? Those of us who practice in critical care long enough know that you can be in a place with four beds and no ventilators, and technically it's called an ICU. Or you can be in a, you know, 30-something bed, tertiary level, level one trauma center type facility, ICU. So all ICUs are not created equal. In addition, for nurses, and somewhat for PAs too, right? I'm not going to presume to know the background or the requirements for PAs. I'll let Melissa speak to this. But for nurses, to become a nurse practitioner, you have to be a nurse first. Now, different programs have different requirements. Some require still having a year or two of critical care experience before you can be admitted to an acute care program. Others, there's no prerequisite for requirements for that at all. But even again, let's say you have 2 years of experience, right? You have 2 years of experience in an ICU. Was that 2 years of ICU experience in a little tiny I see you in the middle of nowhere? Or was that a big place where you were seeing a lot? Or were you in a very specialty I see, right? You're in a big academic medical center, but you're in a, you know, a 30-bed cardiac surgery ICU where you're really only seeing a handful of things. You're just knowing them really, really well. And so I sort of always say, depending on what your background is, if you feel like it would be beneficial, then you should look into them.
Well, and the real question, I think, is not, does someone get something out of one of these programs? It's, do they get something they wouldn't get in their on-the-job training? Because that's always going to happen everywhere. And they say, oh, yeah, I have a lot to learn about critical care, but they'll teach me that when I get hired. And that may or may not be true, but presumably you're getting something different in a when you're hired for a specifically training position. And I guess that's maybe one of the linked questions here, Melissa. What are the elements that we're seeing in many of these programs? What are you doing in a lot of them? Certainly that might be different than you'd just be doing in a staff position. But I actually would rather ask, what do you think should be an element of these programs? Perhaps there is or is not some reasonably well codified best practices or thing, you know, elements of such post-grad programs. But what do you think people should look for? Because in such a casual ad hoc environment, there's always a room that people are just making up as they go, or even abusing the concept and saying, oh yeah, we have a training program here. It involves us paying you little, you working a lot, and we reap those benefits without you getting anything out of it.
Great question. So, and that's part of what the mission of APAP and APGAP are here to serve, is to really be a resource for program directors to ensure that they're delivering a quality education cohort after cohort and not sort of making it up as they go. But first, for those looking for a program, I would establish, is there leadership? I.e., without leadership, you can't really have a formal program. And then within that leadership, how much of the dedicated FTE is dedicated to fellowship operations and fellow success? There may be both a PA and an NP. There may be just one or the other, but then they'll have a multidisciplinary faculty supporting the fellows. The second is, what is the curriculum? So that includes rotations, rotation objectives, the independent educational elements. So what type of teaching? Is there a SIM skills / center engagement portion? What activities? Are there procedures? Are there various critical thinking and critical analysis demonstrations that need to occur? Are there family meetings and or certain resuscitation skills that must be observed? And then based off the observations and maybe even testing, how is the fellow evaluated to ensure that they're competent? And then in addition, what type of retention and or metrics does this program have to publicly share? Many of these programs are trained to retain. While some are not, there is something to be said for how those professionals then go on to succeed. Are they more productive than their non-fellowship trained counterparts? Are they more engaged than their non-fellowship counterparts? So objectively, how are we able to compare the fellow-trained population to the non-fellow-trained population? And then while these folks are traversing in their post-fellowship time, what additional professional opportunities are they taking part of? Are they in professional development? Are they in career advancement? Are they involved in clinical leadership, scholarly work, publications, et cetera?
Yeah, so I think those are good questions to ask. So that's the second thing that I get after, should I do a program, is which program should I do? And I think those are the sort of things that you need to look into. This is the sort of things that I tell people, you know, when you're picking a program, you know, make sure you're picking a good program. It should be a training program, like you said, not just, like Brandon said, somebody that's going to take advantage of some cheap labor for a little while. We've sort of talked about, should I do one, and, you know, which one should I do? We've talked a little bit about advantages. Let's talk about some of the disadvantages of doing a program like this, because there are some, right? Let's be upfront and realistic about this. There are some downsides to doing this.
Certainly. And the most obvious that many people complain about is the lower initial compensation. There is, in my opinion, a cost that comes along with quality and quantity assurance, meaning if I know I'm going to be entering into a year-long contracted fellowship with deliverables that I'm expected to perform, as well as expectations that I can expect from my employer, then there's a cost to some of that reassurance and to some of that opportunity and to some of that investment. So some of that cost is leaving money on the table to ensure that you're invested in, as opposed to an on-the-job or onboarding program, which may see its terms, i.e. a certain amount of time, maybe a de-escalated patient volume. But what I hear often is there's so much to be done in the clinical space that often those accountability metrics go unmatched. The second thing that I often hear people complain about is the limited flexibility, i.e. many of these programs offer some limited paid time off. There may be some additional hours, such as not just a 40-hour week job, but maybe a 60, 70, or even 80-hour week job. And again, the intent behind these is to really ensure that you're optimizing the year-long clinical training, which does come at being in the hospital more hours than just your run-of-the-mill on-the-job trainee. But again, it's a one-year time limit. And I think for many people, 1 year goes by in a blink of an eye. I think another thing is when there's limited literature for people to turn to say what is truly the value, it's having a conversation with the future program to say, am I going to be hired here? What is the likelihood that I'm going to be hired here? How will I ensure that I have a competitive salary at the end of my fellowship? So ensuring that there's some financial or competitive advantage of completion of that program. Many offer a higher starting salary. Many graduates are also offered a higher sign-on bonus than a typical employee. So I think if they're able to, again, get those questions asked upfront, it really helps ensure that there's, you know, program quality assurance.
Is there, and people who are asking about things like salary, it's a little easier to get a sense for that market for regular positions, either asking around, you could see how jobs are being advertised, or I know for, you know, PAs, the AAPA releases a salary survey they do yes. every year, if you're a member, that sort of thing. Is there any data like that available for these post-grad programs? Just so you can get some idea, like you looked at a position, they said, oh, we're going to pay you $10 a week or something. And you're like, is that normal? I mean, perhaps you're not doing this for the money, quote unquote, but you also don't want to, you know, you want to be aware if this place is paying 20 grand more than that place. Is there anywhere people can turn to for those kind of numbers?
Excellent question. So APAP and APGAP last year surveyed all of our program directors who are affiliated with our membership. And we should be publishing this information by the year's end, 2025. I will sneak peek. Most of the salaries range between $65,000 and $78,000. Recognizing if you are in a higher cost of living area of the country, there's typically a higher salary. And if you're in a lower cost of living part of the country, we also saw trends with academic medical centers versus non-academic medical centers. So those who were affiliated with academic medical centers typically offered a little bit lower starting salary. I'm sorry, a lower fellowship salary than those who were at non-academic medical centers. And part of the hypothesis was most of these academic medical centers do come with greater access to resources. They're often in more metropolitan cities with a lot more, we'll say, competitive advantage from a hiring perspective. More people are willing to move to those areas. So there's more people waiting in line for those positions as opposed to your more rural non-academic centers where you may have to attract someone with a little bit higher salary to take that position.
I'm just interested to hear that there are rural non-academic centers who are running training programs.
You'd be surprised. And part of that strategy, I believe, has come from challenges to retain. So many of those programs offer a 3-year contract or a 3-year minimum time commitment to do the fellowship for 1 year and then stay at least for 2 years after to ensure that there's this workforce pipeline.
So they're using these programs as a way to attract future employees.
Absolutely.
Or try to feed into that.
Well, and I think that's one of the big differences between these programs and the sort of traditional medical residencies, right? Medical residencies, for the most part, are designed to train physicians, not to retain them, but just to train them. And if, you know, I mean, a lot of places hire their residents if they have positions, but that's not the end goal, right? It's to train people and send them out into the world. Whereas a lot of the APP fellowships and residencies, one of their goals is to sort of, like you said, it's a pipeline to keep good people. And I know that's one of the things that we have kind of looked at is, you know, this is in addition to a training opportunity, it's also sort of a 1-year job interview. Do we like you? Do you think you're going to be good? And of course, if we've invested in training you, then we'd like to hire you. But what do you know? You have a sense, you have a much bigger program than the ones I've been involved with. Do you have a sense of, is that a common, what's the most common approach from a applicant standpoint, right? People who say, I want to do this training so that I can then get a leg up on getting a job at this place. Or do you see people come through who say, I want to do this training and I have no intention of staying at this place. I'm going to get trained and then go somewhere else that I'm already interested in going, but I want better training first.
Well, because the two subtexts there are, one, can you even get a job at places who have programs, right? Because a lot of them are taken by graduates. And two, if you want to get in the program and you don't want to work there, should you pretend that you do?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to put it.
Both great questions. So first, I would say, look at the mission of the program. If they are truly a train to retain program, it will likely come up in the interview, your intent or your attraction to that city or that specialty, that hospital, that geographic region. And in many fellowship interviews, there's a rubric system. And part of that rubric system is their intentionality to stay post-fellowship. If it's not a train to retain, then 100%, I think the ball field is wide open. Candidates can apply nationally. I would definitely not advocate for any dishonest answers during an interview, but I've also seen where, in my personal program, I've seen where folks have moved from different geographic regions and the way that they've seen their APPs utilized in the system, the satisfaction of those who have either gone on to stay with the team after fellowship, or even the APPs who haven't trained, who just carry this deep sense of gratitude and satisfaction for where they work. Like, that means a lot to our trainees. And many have been convinced to stay, even not initially coming with the intent to stay. Kind of on the flip side of that, if you compare residency and PA fellowships or residencies, they're fundamentally set up quite different. The federal government funds many residency training programs, meaning it's not necessarily coming out of the operational dollar of the hospital system to support those trainees. Whereas that is not the case, by and large, by most APP fellowship training programs. So to make the case or to develop this sustainable model so that you're not losing money, quote unquote, by operating these programs, many have looked at retention as a huge way to show return on investment. In many ways, that retention has been proven, again, higher yield is when fellows are more productive post-fellowship, when fellows are more engaged than your non-fellowship trainee APPs, and then looking at sort of other tangible contributions, whether that be leadership, professional development, et cetera, like who's often stepping in these roles. And what we have seen is we have a high percentage of our fellow graduates raising their hand to say yes.
So if you're the pure-hearted clinical educator who's trying to pitch to the administrators that you want to start a program, one of the arguments may be that more of these people will stay here and work and they will be more productive, better people, and eventually, I guess, make money or something like that. So even if you're not breaking even on the front end, it ends up paying you back.
Yes.
I guess I have to, just to tackle this question, what should we be calling these programs? Should we call them residencies, fellowships? Does it matter? I mean, names can always be hot button issues, or does no one really care and you can call it what you want?
We have debated this at the national level, both the APAP and ABGAP leadership, to hopefully unify across the country what we're calling these APP postgraduate training programs. Given their elective nature, and that has been sort of a position statement of both of these organizations, we do not necessarily want to advocate for these programs to become a mandatory element of training to practice in that specialty. So given its elective nature, that it in the medical vernacular aligns better with the term fellowship than residency, but we also understand that some of these programs have been operating for decades and a name change would be a major cultural issue. So we're pushing towards unification, but certainly have a long way to go.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like we often turn to the physicians for to kind of see how things are done because they've just been doing things for longer. But the analogy really just breaks down because your argument makes sense. But you could also imagine someone saying, okay, you're doing a fellowship. What was your residency? Well, no, we didn't do one of those. It's right to that. But that already is the case because you're doing critical care, which for them is a specialty, and we presumably are not coming from a more general field. So it's kind of just its own thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, we often do sort of look to, well, how are the physicians doing this? Because they've been doing it longer, like you said. But it's not a one-to-one. It's not an apples to oranges. It's not apples to apples. It's apples to oranges comparison, right? Because, you know, like you said, critical care for a physician is a fellowship. So critical care for NPs and PAs should therefore be a fellowship, right? Well, what if you have a program that's just in general internal medicine? That's a residency program for physicians. Should that be a residency for APPs, et cetera? Should you have to do a residency as a PA or an NP in medicine before then you do one in critical care? You know, and all this sort of gets back to the fact that most of us, I think, like Melissa said, would like to see this remain a voluntary program. The more hurdles, I guess, we place in front of people getting into practicing, the less attractive the APP route becomes in general, right? One of the benefits of being an NP or a PA is reduced barrier to entry. You don't have to take on the debt, the time, et cetera, of medical school, residency, fellowship, et cetera. You know, I always say this with NP practice, the more we keep advocating for, now you have to have a doctorate, now you have to have this, now you have to that. Well, maybe I should just have gone to medical school.
Yeah. And the other question I think is obvious to ask with how these programs are built is you can go to some of these as an NP, you can go to some as a PA, and some don't care. They'll accept either. What's your perspective on this? Should we just be kind of role agnostic? Because many places, the positions you're hired into are fairly agnostic. And I would argue those that are not, many should be, because people are really doing the same roles. Of course, there are some differences, including just some administrative ones. And oftentimes they're just historical things. But what do you think? I mean, should we just be calling these sort of, as we've been saying, APP programs versus a PA or NP program?
I have observed the general nomenclature for the population that includes PAs and NPs to be advanced practice provider or APP. And like you said, many of these positions outside of fellowship hire equally PAs and NPs. Many fellowship programs have also trended that way. Where I've seen more, we'll say, specialized educational requirements is the adoption of the consensus model for our nurse practitioners. The consensus model adoption can help guide the best hiring practices to ensure someone's education and training aligns with the population that they'll be served. And the fellowship can really help re-solidify and confirm medical knowledge and practice expertise, again, within that population scope. The one very delineated population served that I have seen is with our Veterans Administration fellowships. They do very specifically hire for PAs and NPs, and part of that comes from they have a separate funding source. So those may not be flexible, but I have seen others who maybe just market to PAs or NPs actually extend the flexibility if an alternative profession reaches out.
Yeah, I feel like it's more likely to come up because it was structured in a certain way, like the money is coming from a department or something like that. And then things feed themselves, right? Because once it starts a certain way, it can be hard to change. Or even you have something like, oh, there's a NP fellowship, so we have a PA fellow. Why would we make ours everyone? It's like trying to balance things out or something. And like everyone has to get on board at the same time. But I mean, that's real life, I guess. But certainly from the clinical perspective, far more commonalities than differences.
Yeah. And I'll tell students a lot of times too, if you're looking for a program and you see it's a program and it's marketed, like, for example, like nurse practitioner students, if it's marketed as a quote PA fellowship, but you think it looks really great and it ticks all your boxes and stuff, I always say there's no harm in asking, you know, are you guys truly a PA only program, or is it just sort of historically called that, or you know, like you said, we kind of started it. You know, surgery is a great example, right? Surgery historically hires PAs more than NPs, and so maybe it's a program that historically we've always kind of hired PAs, but we're certainly open to NPs or vice versa. So I think it never hurts to ask. And you may get a no, we for X, Y, and Z reasons only hire NPs or we only hire PAs. But yeah, I agree. I think most programs are probably at least open to both.
Yeah, perhaps you'll be the first.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we've touched on kind of like who should do these programs, why should I do them, why maybe should I not do them, the political football of what should they be called and what should they not be called, et cetera. Let's sort of take a big step back. You mentioned already for people out there who maybe are not students, they're not looking to train, but they're like, this sounds like an interesting idea. Maybe I'm into teaching and I think maybe my system could benefit for this. What do you say to people who say, we don't have anything like this, but it sounds cool. Should I start one?
Yes. And nationally, we get this question probably most frequently. There's a national conference that both the APAP and APGAP organizations co-sponsor to help provide those people who are in the pre-contemplation phase, or maybe, hey, I've been given a directive by my department even to start this, but I don't really know where to go or where to turn. So there's leadership at the national level that can meet with any prospective fellowship program directors or faculty members to help set you in the right direction and provide some resources to help, again, get you started. I think without that, you can also sort of do some of this homework on your own. It starts with, what sort of resources do you have to make this happen? Are you being asked to do this on your time off? Is there dedicated professional time? Because without those things, I don't know that you're going to be wildly successful. Nor should we be asked to do something work related to this magnitude in our off time. After you get the buy-in and you sort of have a starting point, what do you want this to look like and what timeline are you working with? It typically takes about 18 to 24 months to really build a program, market your program, interview for your program, and then onboard and hit start after the onboarding. Many people, I think, underestimate how much work it actually takes to build a fellowship program. So making sure that you just do your homework, whether that's partnering with another specialty and sort of offering two or three track starts at the same time, whether you're just going to offer this through the department, are you going to partner with your office or your Center for Advanced Practice and what resources they have? But the biggest advice I think I have is just to be really intentional with the performa that you develop and how you want this to launch. And we can certainly get into some specifics if you want to dive into program development.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that. Because I think we've mentioned a couple of things that people should look for when they're choosing a program. And I think those are good things to consider if you're starting a program, right? Make sure that you really are offering an educational value and not just a sort of cheap labor farm. But you know, what are some things that we should be sure that we're including if we're starting a new program?
Great question. So who's going to run your program? And how are they going to be supported by the enterprise or by the team? Really understanding why we're launching this program. So do you have goals, objectives? Do you have a problem that you're trying to solve with the implementation of this program? Helping understand the current state. So getting metrics, productivity metrics, satisfaction metrics, things like turnover rates, all of those things will be taken into consideration to help cultivate what this looks like. Next is curriculum development, meaning what rotations do you have? What mentors and preceptors do you have? With each rotation, how are you building each and every rotation? I.e., your neuro ICU experiences and education are going to look very different than your CT ICU education and experiences. How are you going to train those mentors and preceptors to then evaluate your fellow's performance? Some of that is faculty development. Some of that is really just getting on paper how you want this assessment to look, what metrics you're going to be following, maybe what targets professionally the fellow has to meet, whether that be patient encounters, whether that be, again, specific experiences or demonstrations that the fellows must design or meet. Deliverables. So what sort of educational accomplishments are you going to add to the fellowship? Professional presentations, case write-up presentations, quality improvement work. Again, these add huge value adds, in my opinion, compared to an onboarding program. And then at the end of fellowship, how are you assessing the return on investment and the impact that this is having on your system?
Yeah, the thing I would add to that too is, because you mentioned what separates it from onboarding, is to make sure that you are offering something that separates it from onboarding, right? I've been asked, several times to, can we extend, the same training, say we offer in the sim lab, can our new grad, new hires come to the sim lab? And my answer is generally no, because we've asked our fellows to take a pay cut. We've asked our fellows to work a little bit harder than they ordinarily would and do a little bit more. And part of, again, our contract with them is we're providing them with some value for that sacrifice. And that value should not be then extended to just anyone. At the same time, I am sympathetic to the person who says, well, I just graduated from school and I took this job and I'm kind of feeling a little over my head and I could use some extra training. And I go, yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. And let's see if we can figure out a way to get you some extra training and help. But you can't just have the fellowship experience without being in the fellowship program.
Well, and many of these programs are in places that are, doing physician post-grad programs. Is or should a lot of the training experiences for RAPPs be either inspired by those or actually just shared with them? Like, can they share some of their training?
That's a good question. I think it really depends on what's the culture of your institution. If you have a culture that is very symbiotic and does a lot of multidisciplinary learning, then I think adding another learner type to that in educational experience that's being offered may be helpful. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. In some institutions, they're very culturally different, where there's a resident teaching service and there's an APP teaching service literally within critical care or fill-in-the-blank specialty, in which case it may make more sense to really invest in developing and diversifying those APP-centric resources that could be modeled after what GME has employed, but is really keeping a separate but equal experience to those APPs coming through that.
Just, I guess, for one other practical question, if someone's listening to this and like, hey, I think this is exactly what I want to do, where should I go? Is there just like a list of programs? I mean, is there a registry or just Google? But
Google is a good place to start, although I'll say probably not the superior resource. Both APAP and APGAP have member registries. Now, this means that there's a program that's existed across the country that says, hi, I am an established program and I really want to be a part of this culture of program directors from across the country. I want to have a program that really aligns with the values that other programs across the country are also upholding. While be it this is not the exhaustive registry of all programs, is a great place to start. You can sort by state, you can sort by specialty to help narrow in on the specialty of choice. Another option is, depending on where you want to move to or where you foresee yourself starting your career, do really a focused review of that, whether hospital system, geographic region, to see what types of fellowships may be in the area that may not pay for that search engine optimization to be the first search when that person Googles postgraduate training program.
And how many, I mean, perhaps this is unknowable, but how many of the programs out there are affiliated with one of your two organizations? I mean, is it the majority or?
I'll speak to the APAP side. As of January of 2025, we had 136 unique institutions that were sponsoring fellowship programs, but one institution may offer multiple tracks, which is pretty impressive. We've seen a huge growth, especially since around the early 2000s. The first PA fellowship, for example, though, started just 2 years after the PA profession, almost over 50 years ago now. So they've been around for a long time, but I don't think have really caught on or have been highly sought out after until probably the last decade or two.
And do you have any idea the denominator of how many programs there are total, or I guess you might not know about them if they're not.
And I think that's what makes getting a good landscape snapshot so difficult, because you do have such small operations where you may just be accepting one fellow at a rural hospital that, unless you're intimately informed of that program, may never know about that program. So the mission of our organizations, we're actually looking to combine to have one resource center for all APP fellowships from across the country. And part of that aftermath is to have a better understanding of who all is out there to help best represent you, educate you, be an advocate on your behalf, et cetera.
Yeah, there certainly are big programs out there that are very well known. But there's a lot of programs out there. I hear all the time, students will tell me, I'm looking at this program in such and such. What can you tell me about it? And I go, I didn't even know they had a program. So I can't tell you anything, obviously. And let me do some digging. Maybe I know some people. But the number of programs we hear students finding out about simply by word of mouth is astonishing to me still, after all the years I've been involved with this, a PA at my program, at my hospital, did this program and raved about it. Or one of my physicians heard about this program somehow. Like, they heard somebody speak at a conference and they were like, it sounds really interesting. And so they pushed their students that they know to look into it. So,
well, and perhaps in some cases they're just new. I mean, it certainly seems like there's a real growth in the number of programs being launched in just the past 5 some years.
And then, too, I've seen multiple hubs of organizational energy around fellowship specialties. For example, there are 3 critical care professional organizations, or I should say 3 well-known, ATS, CHEST, and SCCM. SCCM alone offers what's called a sponsored fellows program, meaning if your program director is a member, you can actually enroll your APP fellows for free. So just through SCCM alone, there's been a lot of energy around collaborating with critical care fellow program directors or even fellow alumni or leadership. And there's a task force that sort of maintains a listserv, and there are over 35 programs who are represented across this landscape. And I think most of them would say they identify as an academic medical center, but there are several who don't. But yet not all of those programs would be APAP members either, because I think some see, hey, I don't need to pay a small membership fee to be a member of this organization, as I better align with maybe the organizational mission of SCCM.
Let me ask you a kind of hyper-practical question. Someone goes to one of these programs, they graduate, they go off into the world. Should they make more money? Or, you know, in some way have their compensation account for the additional training that they have that somebody else may not have? And if so, is there some standard or accepted or at least recommended way to do that? I know for myself, I have either heard of or seen practices like people giving you credit for additional 2 or 3 years of experience in whatever their pay scale is. I have not had a ton of luck, but I have been able to argue for at least one extra year, basically arguing you did about twice as many hours in the 1 year that you worked. But most places just don't have an approach, unless I think they have some of their own programs and they're used to dealing with their own graduates and have an approach to that. But
yes, great question. So unfortunately, there is not a lot of literature out there that really compares, or I should say, provides guidance on how much your fellowship grad should be making based off fellowship graduation, the specialty for which they are going into. On the other hand, there is an organization that serves as a consultant for many institutions across the country, that is Sullivan and Cotter. Sullivan and Cotter provides APP benchmarking data nationally for various specialties. Many fellowships have turned to the APP Sullivan and Cotter benchmarking data to help stratify, based off my fellow performance, what do they compare to? I.e., are they comparable to a 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, 10-year APP? And if that's the case, many have then used that to help inform how to escalate pay or starting salary post-fellowship. So in our institution, our APP fellow graduates are more productive than your 2-year tenured fellowship graduate. So we will escalate them on our fixed pay scale based off experience, giving them at least 2 full years of credit, in some cases 3, and affording an additional sign-on bonus for a commitment to stay X number of years beyond the fellowship tenure point. While this practice, I'll say, is maybe newer, this was a very hot topic at this past year's conference, and I think we'll see more programs transitioning to an evidence-based approach to supporting fellow salary in this way.
Yeah, it would be nice if there was more standardization, but that just comes down to how kind of ad hoc all this stuff is in general. I will say that I wouldn't expect for anyone applying to one of these programs that you will ultimately come out the richer for it. I mean, maybe, but maybe the opposite. Like there's no reason to expect that. Do it because of how it will change the nature of the work that you do. And not because you think you'll work hard and then eventually make more money.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of in line with the type of people I think that we see do programs, right? Is that, and I don't want to paint people with too broad a brush, but I think we see people do these programs who are interested more so in, I feel like it will make me a better provider, right? And I don't necessarily need evidence that that's true.
But so, I mean, that's early adopters, right? So as it gets more mainstream, there's always someone who's like, oh, like maybe this will help me pay off my mortgage or whatever.
Yeah. And I think that the people who think that are the people who don't intend to not to do these programs. And like you said, maybe that'll change. And maybe if we have some sort of standardized evidence that there are sort of tangible benefits to these programs instead of the more intangible things that we've been talking about, that'll change.
Right.
Lastly, I want to bring up what I think sometimes is a little bit of a sticky subject with these programs, at least in the NP world. So I'm in academics as well. I teach in an acute care nurse practitioner program. And so I know a lot of people in academics. And I was really sort of surprised when I got into academics at the negative pushback that I got from other academics regarding these types of programs. Does that exist in the PA world, first of all?
So back in around 2014 timeframe, there was actually a coalition of naysayers who advocated that there should be a professional opposition statement, meaning the entire society, or I should say the American Academy of PAs and their stakeholders, came out and said, we do not think that these programs should exist, nor should PAs seek these at any point during their training. Which was really, I mean, to have a strict opposition statement like that just can kind of put a bad taste in people's mouths, because the mission at the time was, again, these are elective training programs, again, for the right person, the right specialty at the right institution, can be career changing for the better. There was no intent to ever advocate to make these mandatory. And it took 3 years of aggressive advocacy at the national level to get that opposition statement overturned. Now, we were not asking for a acceptance statement. It was really just don't oppose us publicly. With our work in collaboration with the PA Education Association, we've worked very hard to establish better rapport with the program directors to, again, reiterate what the mission of these programs are and to know what their resources are should a student reach out with questions about seeking a postgraduate training program. So some have even had alumni come back and provide positive testimony, and they invite program directors into their training program year to talk to fellows about fellowship options. So I think in the last decade, we've come a far way, and I'm so excited about the diversity of we'll say, relationships that have been built and the patience of the educators, because the message isn't your education wasn't good enough. It was due to the duration of education, i.e. it's a 2-year program, and there's just not enough time to really become the content expert in every single medical or surgical subspecialty that if someone wants to go into something quite specialized, that these programs are one avenue to gain that specialty knowledge, education, and experience.
Yeah, and that's sort of what I've seen evolve in the nurse practitioner world as well. Most of the people I hear, and now whether this is really truly changed attitudes or people have just realized that, you know, the wind is blowing a different direction and maybe I should just keep my thoughts to myself. And I don't really care which one that is, but most of them now are more like, I don't know that these are worth it. Not necessarily the strict opposition, right? Like, I mean, I remember when I first got involved with fellowship programs, we went to try to partner with some people in academics and we were told specifically, not only do I not think there's a need for this, but I think this is offensive to me because it implies that I'm not teaching everybody what they need to know. And I said, like, you, I mean, when I was in your program, you freely admitted you weren't teaching me everything you needed that I needed to know because there are constraints, right? You can't know everything about everything. And I think it's interesting, though, that, you know, medical schools don't, and maybe this is, again, historically, because it's so established, but medical schools, I don't think, get offended that they're like, well, you should, from day one of graduation, be prepared to practice the deepest, darkest subspecialties of medicine. You know, everybody sort of freely admits that, yeah, we can't get into all that detail with stuff. All right. Well, I think we've done a pretty good job of covering this topic. Brandon, do you have anything else pressing on your mind there?
No, I mean, there's all we can do is scratch the surface because it's not like this is a well carved out area and it's just a matter of explaining what's going on. There is still a lot of variation in what programs look like, who goes to them, why, what they do after, and so on. So I think everyone has to kind of just introspect and look, see what they're looking for. But that, you know, perhaps leaves lots of room for people to, as is always the case, kind of make their own path forward and look at the program they're looking at, seeing what they would get out of it, asking, is that something that they expect would benefit them? And that's that. There's not too much more to it than that. Of course, you're trying to guess the future and what you'll get and what you'll want and so on. That's always a bit of a gamble. But there's not a lot of wild cards or surprises here. It sort of is what it seems to be. We'll see what the future holds. I mean, things will change and stuff that evolves in a kind of grassroots way has a tendency to end up gelling into a more, you know, concrete and immutable form later. But I don't really think we're there yet, so.
Yeah. All right. Well, Melissa, thanks for joining us. And I'll just sort of say in terms of wrapping up, for folks out there who are listening, like we've said over and over again, if you think this is something that you could benefit from, do a little research, figure it out. And like Melissa said, in most cases, it's one year of your life, right? Which seems like a huge deal when you're on the near side of it. But as those of us who have been around for a while know that once you're on the far side of it, you go, God, that's went by so fast. Right. So don't stress so much about should I? I don't think it's hard to make too big of a mistake here. If you think you should and you do it and you get in and go, I don't know if that was worth it. Okay. It was a year. Right. So
another flip question is, what would you be missing by not participating in a fellowship?
Yeah, because typically it gets harder to do later, whether that means you're older and more tired, the loss of pay is harder to deal with. If you need to move, that gets harder. So I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, I'll do it in 5 years if I need to. The odds of that are really much lower for most people.
Well, yeah, and a lot of programs won't accept people that have experience. They're looking specifically for fresh clay to mold, right?
Yeah, there's like your past your expiration date, yeah, buddy. Yeah.
And I'll say this too, some of our fellows at UK have gotten to do some pretty cool elective experiences that have made me go, God, I wish I could go back and be a fellow, even if I didn't use that in my life, right? Even though that experience probably wouldn't change the way I practice, it's just something that seems really cool. And I would have not gotten to do that experience if I had not done this fellowship. To me, a lot of times I go, that would have been enough for me right there. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us. And we hope that this conversation has been enlightening to you. As always, this is just our opinions, right? We don't necessarily speak for our respective employers or organizations, even those that we represent in an official capacity. So thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.